Haitian member of the London family. Lives in the London community of Texas.
Right. Let's start and let us find out something about how your grandfather decided to settle this area. Do you remember about when he would have come here?
Yes, I think it would be safe to say at the turn of the century.
You know what his motivation was for settling?
Well, Granddaddy had quite a large family. He had 5 boys and 2 girls. And they originally had migrated from Tennessee and had settled in the central part of the state. And at this time, there was quite a boom in this area, you know, land development. And so Granddaddy came down and looked the place over and had an opportunity to make a business deal with the developer and settled it. This is interesting. I think his deed is number 1 off of the old Laurelis Ranch, which is a part of the original King Ranch. You see,
can you say this is about 1900?
About 1900, maybe 1890s, somewhere around there. I really don't know the dates on it. And he had, as I said, 5 sons, 2 daughters, my grandmother, and. I'm assuming that he wanted to just maybe expand his own life. I imagine this was it, you know, and give better opportunities to his family. I'm assuming this.
Do you know if when he first came, he did farming or ranching?
Well, yes. Granddaddy did farming. Now, Granddaddy never did ranch, but it was real interesting. I think this is quite typical of pioneers to do this way. They have a great decision to make whether or not to rear their sons to follow in their footsteps, you know, and take over the business and go on, or to educate their children as individuals and let them expand in their own interest. But I think it's interesting that in Granddaddy's family, his boys all settled around him. He had this area, so one son would buy maybe a mile this way and another one maybe a mile back here all around, and this is how it became the area that it is. Just his sons who settled rather near the old original homestead.
And so when you go down the highway and you go through the London community, what you're going through is all the different sons' property.
That's right, and their sons now, like Billy Ray, for example, you see.
The crops at that time, do you know, happen to know what they would have been?
Oh, gee, my daddy would love to be sitting here telling you all about that. He'd love to talk about no, the soil was very fertile. I'm sure it took a mighty lot of nurturing right in the beginning. And, you know, I can't tell you whether this was cleared land or not. And I don't really think it was, though. I think that they had to go in and clear it. It's very reasonable that it would not be cleared, since it was not farming land and coming from the King Ranch, you know. This division was called the Laurelis area. So I'm assuming that it was in its natural state. So good fertile soil like that, so not abused and not used too much, was rather productive, very productive. But I'd have no idea just how productive.
Oh, Granddaddy. We mentioned all the boys buying property around their father. What did they diversify, or did they stick with farming?
Some of them did, and some of them went into the ranching along with their farming, but chiefly you would say farming. And then one went into, as a matter of fact, my father did, went into vegetables. And became a shipper. He shipped his vegetables from here in Corpus, and I believe set up a place at Mathis too.
The boys that are still there, I notice they have a gin, and on the front of the gin it says London Co-op. How long has the gin been there?
Well, this is not the original gin. The original gin was down at the corner where you turn from going to the Chapman Ranch Road, you turn to the right, you know, to go down there, the original gin was there. And, you know, Dr. Benign? Not Dr. Benign, Dr. Arnhem?
Right.
In Crawfus? Well, his father owned that first gin that was set up there.
The corner at Chapman Ranch and what's now the end of Ayers.
That's right. That's right. The London Co-op gin, I don't know the date on that. It's been there for quite some long time, and I don't know what all was involved in the organization of it, you know. And I don't know who all is involved, but it's been there for many, many years. I just don't know about that.
When you look back on things that you can remember, what could you tell us about the London School?
Well, yes, I think the school was just an upshot of a necessity that came along. You must remember there were no highways, no roads paved or anything, you see. It would have been impossible to have driven the 10 miles into Corpus. So that stemmed, I'm sure, from just a need for the community. There were quite a few of us, of the third generation, I would be the third generation, who needed school, of course. And other families had begun to come in there and farm and ranch. They had children, so the school was just a natural development. It was just an upshot of the growth of the community. And this family, my family, have always been church has always been a great part of their lives. And so I'm sure that Granddaddy saw the need. I don't even remember when the church went up, but I'm sure that Granddaddy saw a great need for having also a church. And they were built right side by side. You don't see that now because the church was sold a few years ago. But they were just right side by side. So that was really the hub of the community. If we couldn't do it church, we could go over it and do it school, like square dancing and such as that.
Did your grandfather build the school, or was that a community effort?
Well, I'm sure it was. Must have been a community effort, but Granddaddy, I'm sure, was the innovator of it, as he was the church. I don't recall, but of course I don't recall. But I'm sure Granddaddy and his sons were.
Was there anything that you could think of that would be unique about the school? When you think back, was it one room school, or was it, did it have several rooms?
Yes, we did. And at that time, I don't know about the first years when it was in operation, but we had an excellent affiliation up through, I believe, the 10th grade. Good. We had very, very good teachers out there. One of them, I know, Dr. Simmons taught out, and his wife taught out there for about 3 years, and then he went on to State University and taught there, became manager, one of the business managers of State University. We had, the qualifications were pretty great for the teachers. We had very, very, so you know, in your life, there is always somehow a teacher that stands out, you know, in your life.
Mm-hmm.
Makes an impression, and when you think back of your school years, I had one teacher out there at London that sticks with me, and one at college that stuck with me all during the year. But outside of that, these two teachers, I believe, are the only teachers that I felt was a great influence, but this teacher was. Unique now, it was, I guess, just a typical, we were competitive in sports. Petronila was our big, big deal of the year, you know, and I played on the basketball team. And the year that we could beat Petronila, that was a big year. Boys had a basketball game, but they didn't have football. And we all rode our horses to school, and, of course, we had an hour for lunch. Everybody took their lunch. This was before the cafeteria was built. And one of the pastimes we had at lunchtime then, we had an hour, was to get out and race on our horses, which was fun. We had two schools. We had one for the people who regularly attended, and then we had another school for children who came in late.
The migrant people.
Yeah. This was set up for the purpose of helping these children become more oriented to the way of the community and the way of the school, to help them make an adjustment, and then they came into the regular school. Also, they built teacherages. The teachers lived right there on the campus, right there on the school.
Were they cottages or type
yes,
of arrangements?
Yes, they were. Little five-room, two-bedroom cottages.
Sort of like churches have parsonages.
That's right. It was the same thing. It went along with it, A contract to teach included a house to live in, you see, for the 9 months.
Would there be enough ground that they could also do truck farming or something for
the teacher?
Kitchen garden?
Oh, kitchen garden. No, there was no space around it except just an average yard around each one of the cottages. But those teachers were expected, though, to work in the community just as if they had lived there. The full 12 months. They, if they belonged to the same denomination that the church was, which was Baptist, why they would teach Sunday school on Sunday,
You said the church was sold. Who did they sell it to?
Sold it to to a group of Baptists in Corpus, and it is now known as the Travis Baptist Church. I believe in Travis or Trinity. I have forgotten which it is now. Of course, they have built on it. It was a small church, and they have used it for the center. And then they have built wings all around that, It's quite large. I can't remember now what street it's on here in Corpus. I don't know.
Most people always kind of fondly remember the first time they drove an automobile. Can you remember when you first learned to drive?
Yes, I sure can. I was 11 years of age at that time, and I had three brothers, two of them older than I, and I remember the day, and I don't recall ever having too much interest in driving a car. I was 11, and I just would always run, I guess, and get in the back seat of the car and go along with the family with not much thought. But Daddy decided that I should learn to drive that car, and it was a touring Buick, very low and very long. And the day came that he was to teach me to drive the car. I couldn't see up from my seat. I couldn't see through the steering wheel even, to see the road. However, it would not a hazardous thing because there was no traffic. As a matter of fact, I learned on the way to the pasture, So, but Daddy got in the back seat of the car and he said, okay, it's yours, take it. And when he saw that I couldn't see where I was going, we stopped and he ran back to the garage, to the barn, and picked up a gallon bucket like this and put it back to my back, which held me forward. And then I could see. And so then Daddy got in the back seat of the car. He didn't sit in the front with me either. And said, take it. Well, I can remember how hard it was, down like this to begin with. And I could see the haystack. Well, I headed right out for it. Knocked a few bundles of hay around. No damage done. But anyway, Daddy, the reason for this was very logical. There were not too many telephones out there at that time, and none of the roads were paved. And Daddy said, just suppose your brothers are gone from home, and we need you. We need somebody to drive this car. Suppose your mother gets ill, and you've got to go get to a telephone, call a doctor. So it made sense,
You mentioned the word doctor. What did the people that worked on the farm, how did they get medical attention?
Well, this is something that I guess was characteristic of the time. I know in seeing The Giant, the movie The Giant, it recalled to my mind so much the way we had it, the doctor came out. Well, we had a family doctor who lived here in Corpus, and unless we turned up with something exceptional, he made routine calls. Daddy would have him come out once a month. And first, he'd go down to the houses and check the families down there, all the little children and the daddies and the mamas, you know, and take care of any special thing that had come up. And then after he got through there, well, he'd always come back by the house and line us up, check us. And this was just a routine thing. They took excellent care of the men and families that worked for them in this manner.
Did he also come out to deliver the babies?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh.
You remember what kind of car he drove?
No, I don't. But I'm sure it was one that would take the deep ruts, because we had them, you know. That's pretty black mud out there, pretty black soil. When it rains, it gets pretty bad.
You remember any of the things that people did for fun? Yesterday was the 4th of July, and there seemed to be very little real 4th of July activity in the, around the community here where we are.
Yeah.
Were there any unusual celebrations?
Oh, yes. But then I think that goes along with the time, because this day and time, every day is the 4th of July, you know, or every day is Easter, or every day is Sunday here now. Or every day is Christmas with kids. But, yes, 4th of July, that was always set up, you know, for picnicking and families getting together. And our family was quite large. But it was always what we now would call a covered dish. We called it going picnicking at that time. But our own immediate family had a... this was traditional in our family. Every week we got together on Friday night, and we'd get together at each other's houses. And when we'd be at grandfather's, my grandfather's house, he had a great big old ice cream maker.
Freezer,
yes. This was fun, you know, to get to sit on that while somebody turned. It must have been 10 gallons, I guess. And then everybody would come to their house, and grandmother would have baked cakes or cookies or something, and the older ones would sit around, our parents would sit around and talk and visit, and then we would just turn loose to play our games and do the things, you know, that we wanted to do. And Mother used to, when it was our time to have them at our house, why, they'd make the ice cream, get it all packed down, you know, in salt to keep it from freezing. Mother would have baked cakes and cookies. And then she arranged chairs out on the lawn for conversation. And is customary, I guess, for men to sort of segregate themselves and talk about the crops, and the women talk about other things, you know. And I can remember watching them as a kid. We'd all be over here, you know. We were told to behave ourselves, but have fun over here playing. And we'd play all the games, you know, like... somersaulting and leapfrogging and all that, so hide and seek and those things. And I can remember watching my mother and my uncles and my aunts sitting over there in those chairs, and I'd think, gee, I hope I die before I get so old that I don't enjoy getting out here and turning somersaults. This was a child's angle, I guess, sure. And to me, they were quite elderly, and I guess they were all of 35, maybe.
Sitting and talking was their thing.
And they needed this sort of a thing, you know, because they didn't visit like we visit this day and time. There was no such thing as just running by, you know. This was quite an event when you did.
Was it a common thing for you and your brothers and sisters to go off to college?
Oh, yes. I don't believe the question ever came up. And I don't believe the question ever came up which college. You know, this is just one of the things from the very beginning until the end that parents saw through. And as I said, this family was a church-minded family. And as the boys came along, they went to an academy, a Baptist academy in St. Marcus. Both of them, older ones, graduated. Well, all of them did. Three of them graduated from St. Marcus. And then I enrolled in Baylor immediately and didn't stop until I got through, there was just no question. You know, this was it. It was all set out for you.
And so you, then you went into teaching here in Corpus right away?
No. I had two children before I ever started teaching after I got out, after I got my degree. No, I didn't. This is an interesting fact. I think I forgot to mention to you, talking about the doctors, and it recalls to my mind how we provided for the families, you know. Winters, believe it or not, were a little more severe than they are right now. I think basically this is true. And there's certainly no good roads added to that, you know, the difficulties of getting in and out. So every family had its own commissary for the help. And they came to the same little store in connection with the house in some way, maybe a room that was built on for it or a separate place. And the food was brought out there, say, once a week or once every 2 weeks, as often, you know, as they needed it. And then they would come to the house, to the commissary, and get what they needed, and books were kept right there as they were given their food.
When they paid for the food, did they pay by the month or?
Well,
end
it was
of
mostly
season?
Deducted because we kept a set of books on it, you see, and as they were paid off by the cost of their food, you see, it was just deducted from it. Yep, maybe once a week or once every 2 weeks, I don't
know. What were the main items? Things like flour and salt?
That's right, and dried beans and. Yeah, more things of that order. And, you know, I think here's something else, and I think it's just great that we don't have this day and time, and maybe the faith in other people that people used to have, the confidence and trust that people used to have. I can recall so many times in bad weather, people coming through those roads that were unimproved, you know, and maybe breaking down. Right. Close to our place. And Daddy and Mother, all the men, go out and invite them in and put them up for the night, you know, fix, include maybe four, six, however many people. And in the dinner meal, we'd all sit down and talk. Everybody would have, you know, introduced themselves and found out all about it. This was just a way of life. This was... I guess, being a good neighbor, and yet they never thought of it as being neighborly. Here's a man in need, you know. And now I think we'd hesitate just to bring a stranger in, wouldn't we?
Yes, I know I would.
Well, I would too. But I guess this comes along from the time as much as any other one thing. People were friendly, very, very friendly, and very helpful to other people. And I guess this comes of being probably a pioneer.
How did they haul them back to the house, with mules or with their car when they got stuck in the mud?
According to the distance that they were when they were discovered as not being able to move on any further. No, not cars. That would have complicated it. Horses, mostly.
It seems kind of odd to bring a whole family in and feed them and put them up for the night.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't do it without going to the grocery store two or three times. Could you?
No.
But, you know, they just had a way. I think the pioneers, the early developers of the area, and it was not the most rugged area in the world, of course, but still it was complicated. But, you know, I really think, when I think about this family, I think that probably the love for land was one of the greatest forces in the development of that area. They really loved the land. My father did. After my grandfather had passed on, you know, and then he branched out with more land, and they really loved it. It was a hobby, actually. It was a hobby after Daddy was up in his 80s. He was still, he himself couldn't do it physically, but I mean, he was very active in managing it, and he loved it, and always looking for ways to improve, always. I think this is one, you asked me a moment ago, too, if it was just understood that we'd go on off to school. I think this is true. I think this is the reason why this little school has stood up all these many years out there, because those people are still looking for ways to improve. They did it with their farming, with their implements. Everything was just always looking for a better way or a step up.
How many of the boys are still living in the London community?
Only, well, I have cousins, and I'd have to count those off, but there's only one living of my uncle who would be the second generation of Londons. Just uncle, this one uncle. And there are the third generation, which is of my generation. I guess I may have six.
Are still out there.
Uh-huh.
Farming.
Uh-huh.
I notice when I drive by that most of it is grain farming.
Yes, well.
When did grain become so big?
Oh, that was, I guess, after I left. I can't answer that question. And then they were fortunate about 25 years ago for an oil development to go in out there, which has, I'm sure, improved the community greatly. It's made possible, probably, to have what they do have.
This helps support the school.
Oh yes, uh-huh. The little school is quite modern.
Is the school supported by taxes mostly,
uh-huh.
or
by
taxes?
Mm-hmm.
At first it was sort of a family,
yes,
supported,
uh-huh.
school, and now it has developed,
uh-huh.
into, what, is it a county school?
No, it's an independent school district itself. It has its own, everything. It's
London Independent.
It supports its own bus, too, to transport children, or I should say buses, to transport boys and girls after they have completed, the 10th grade. I don't know how far they are now affiliated in their classes. But say they complete the 9th grade, and maybe there is no 10 and 11 now, I don't know. Buses are provided by the Independent School District, London Independent School District, to bring them in here to the different high schools.
We've been talking about out in the country, but what about the town of Corpus? I understand that back in the 40s that the town was very small and just went sort of to Louisiana Parkway.
Well, I'm sure that probably is true, but I can remember farther back than the 1940s when it was much smaller even so than that. I can well remember when Ocean Drive was just a sandy trail to go through. And as a matter of fact, you wouldn't be too interested in going down there because it was rather hazardous with bushes and little old shrub bushes, you know. It would be a little difficult to get down through there. And I can recall this, which you might like to hear. We have a cousin who was born and reared in London, England, and didn't come to the United States until he was about 21. He settled in San Antonio and then looked us up and became quite friendly and visited down quite a bit, and he was absolutely carried away and excited over the potential development and beauty of Corpus Christi. He just said, it's just bound to be a city one of these days. And in driving down Ocean Drive, he pointed out to my daddy several times the fact that here is this land facing the one drawing card in Corpus Christi, the beautiful bay, you know, and the land could be bought for practically nothing. And he insisted to my daddy that he buy this land. He said, you're foolish to sit right here and not make an investment in this land. Well, daddy never could see land except for the production of what the land could produce, you know. And he'd shake his head over these sand piles along the way. He could have bought it for $1 an acre, if you can imagine.
Ocean Drive
along that area there, yes. And Daddy would look at it and he'd say, you couldn't give it to me, I wouldn't have it. Why, he said, you couldn't grow a bale of cotton on 100 acres of this mess. He just couldn't see it for anything in any way except what can it produce, you know. So, but Lord, we've all lived to see the day that Ocean Drive was quite the spot. Corpus has had a very rapid growth, and still is. I used to take my father out in car just riding around when he was about 85.
On this side, and so when you took him driving when he was 85, where did you go?
I ran mostly to the places that I thought he would be familiar with, you know. And we'd see these large buildings now that dominating the town and the area around. And I'd say, "Now, Daddy, look at that. Can you imagine? Do you remember when?" And he'd stop me. He'd say, "He never could see the buildings. He just never could." He'd say, "Why, this was Old Man Smith's ranch. Or Old Man Jones lived over there, and look what they've done to that." He absolutely never could see it except as it was, you know, as it used to be.
Can you remember the old bridge before the high bridge was built?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
What did you think when they put in the newspaper they're going to build a high bridge?
Oh, I don't know. I guess I'm sure I was all for it. If you remember, at that time, there was quite a lot of conflicting ideas about it. Some wanted a tunnel rather than the bridge. Now, of course, that is very what I term a recent development in Corpus Christi. But, you know, you just see so many changes, not only in the town itself, and I'm sure it's just like any other town. It's just almost a ghost town right downtown. And the shopping and business areas developed in the outskirts of the town, which I think is certainly the trend of development now.
But when the other bridge was there, it was kind of lifted up in the middle, and the ships went through where it lifted up. Did this cause many problems, or what caused them to decide on the high bridge?
Well, it did cause problems because the town was growing so fast and it couldn't accommodate passage. And yes, several times this has happened, enough so that it would make the papers, you know, that the bridge was suspended for so long that traffic was stopped for maybe a mile or a couple of miles back both ways. You know, it became a bottleneck. It was just absolutely a necessity. It just had to keep up with the growth, the other growth of Corpus. And I think one of the things that has been an upshot of that is the development of Portland. And it never had been a little developed town at all. It was just a little place to pass through, you know, to get to some other place. But it certainly did change its face, didn't it?
It's one of the nicer towns around here.
Yeah, I think so too. We have, you know, just a lot of people live over there and come back over here to their jobs every day. I know two or three couples that do that. They have lovely homes over there.
The development of Padre Island, when were you first aware that Padre was out there?
When we were quite young, just kids. This is another thing. You asked a moment ago what we did, you know, for excitement or entertainment, or did we hold two picnics and special days. Yes, we used to go to the island. We were never allowed to go down, of course, by ourselves, but families, the adults, you know, would go with us. And there would be great numbers of us. Maybe, as well as I remember, it was a community affair on several occasions, you know. And we would all have our own tents or our own tents and our own bedrolls, except we didn't have bedrolls. We had cots, you know, and everybody unfolded their cots and such as that. And carried along people who could cook for us and, you know, keep us going. But we'd go over and stay sometimes as many as 3 or 4 days on the island, just camping. And this would be one of those fun things, you know. We could swim, and we could run up and down the beach, and maybe we wouldn't see another soul while we were there except just the group that had gone over.
You mentioned a cousin coming over from England, and the name London always makes you think of England. Do you know where the name of the family derived from?
Yes. It came from there. It came from there, and we have a history on that, but it doesn't have anything to do with this.
South Texas.
No, not a thing. It's just
When the London family came over, they just came in the eastern seaboard and kept traveling till they eventually
migrated on down. And this was it, as far as they were concerned. When they came here, my grandmother's people settled in Tennessee, and they became educators. Hambrides, I believe their names are. And I taught at the University of Tennessee for several years, and it was my privilege to get to look them up. You know, I've never seen any of them, but I really did enjoy these.
I think that you've given us some interesting insight into the London community, and I certainly appreciate it. Thank you.